ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to your extra slice of Worst Foot Forward Trivial Business for May. Of course, extra slice makes it seem as though this were a baking show, but it is not. It is one about heroic failure. So it is called the Third Foot because rarely is a third foot any good, apart from in the most niche dark web-based porno films. I am Ben Vanderveld, and with me is the chiropodist of that third foot, Barry McStay.
I'm here carving verrucas off it as we speak.
Shall you be mother? Whoa, okay. Since the Great Pox hit, we've been trying to do thematically based topics for the third foot. And since this month is my turn, I've taken inspiration from someone who's cropped up time and again on the show, who is St. Simon Stylites, who, if you don't know him, he is the pillar-based saint who stood on a pillar in the middle of a desert for about 30 years. And people visited him, and he mostly told them to bugger off, didn't he?
Yeah, pretty much. He built increasingly tall pillars to try and avoid the crowds.
Yes, and of course, the mistake in that was he could thus be seen from increasingly further distances.
Yeah, and ruined the skyline.
Yeah, there was all sorts of complaints from neighborhood groups
Yeah.
trying to get him pulled down. So yeah, I've looked at, because we are all living in our own little hermitages, I looked up bits and bobs of history about such things. So the term hermit comes from the Latin eremita, which is a Latinization of the Greek eremites, which literally means of the desert or desert dweller, because that's where most of them did. They said, we are going off to the desert to be holy men. And so that's the name that they got. And a lot of the early Christian hermits had the same problem that Simon Stylites had, that people thought because they were such sage beings going out into the desert to meditate upon life's big questions and communicate with the divine, that they would go out there and seek spiritual advice and counsel. And eventually, so many of them acquired so many disciples that they no longer had the physical solitude that they desired. And so in the end, many of them set up basically small cottage industries where they would weave baskets in exchange for bread, and I presume also in exchange for people buggering off and leaving them alone again.
Do you think? I think the problem was that they kept leaving redirect postal addresses. If they'd set up a post box instead of doing
Yes.
that, then no one would be able to find them at all.
What you're saying, that the first PO box address was set up by a hermit.
Yeah, just not wanting people to know where he'd moved to.
Yeah. It's like that's all witness relocation was in ancient times. Just hermits going round exchanging pillars every 6 months.
They've given witness to God and now they need protection.
Yeah. St. Simon Stylites was actually one of the thieves who was meant to be crucified next to Jesus.
He isn't. We know we've talked about them before. They were called Dismas and Gestus.
I mean, Dismas and Gestus has got real Disney sidekick vibes, doesn't it?
Yeah, or real like 1940s British vaudeville double act.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm just imagining them doing jazz hands with stigmata. Obviously, medieval hermits existed as a homage to the originals. I suppose medieval hermits were the Rolling Stones to the muddy waters of the early Christian desert hermits. But because they lived in European cities and couldn't be sent off to the desert, or I guess marshland, they lived the way they lived a hermit-like life was they were either gatekeepers or ferrymen. So medieval hermits were bouncers and taxi drivers.
Amazing. We've talked about in the world of D&D and Dungeons and Dragons. I think we mentioned this, but I find it so funny you mention it again. That in I think the second edition of Dungeons and Dragons, they introduced loads of different classes of thing you could be. So rather than going like there's the fighters and the priests and the magic users, they sort of went, we're going to very specifically outline literally every subdivision within those. And there was one type of character called the Anchorite.
Who I'm about to talk about.
Oh yeah, oh great, you're going to talk about actual anchorites.
Oh yeah, but you tell us
Yeah,
about these.
well, in D&D, the idea behind the anchorite is that you would have some special powers and abilities, but they would be embedded or sort of connected to the place that you had anchored yourself, that you had sort of dedicated your life to, whether it's this cave or working as the ferryman into a particular village. But in a game which bases itself around people going off on long quests. The Anchorite's power dwindles, I think, when he moves about more than a mile away from his anchored location, making him effectively useless.
Oh, that's glorious.
Yeah.
I didn't really know the difference between Anchorites and Hermits until I looked it up. Anchorites live a life of solitude, a religious life of solitude, but they are anchored to a religious building, typically a church. So a small hut or cell is built for them. The door of the anchorage tended to be ceremonially bricked up by the local bishop. Obviously, after the anchorite had moved in.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
Yeah, otherwise the anchorite's just outside going, and I get in, how?
Yeah, you suddenly ended yourself up in a comedy sketch.
Yeah.
Then the bishop manages to brick himself in on the wrong side of the door. You've got a bishop who isn't very good at doing, you know, brickwork in the first place. He's forgotten to bring any cement.
Yeah, do you think that's how Edgar Allan Poe wrote that famous tale of the guy who gets bricked up in the basement?
Yeah, or the Telltale Heart. Yeah, one of those jobbies, or, you know, get buried. Yeah, they just had, oh, we've got bloody anchorites in, we've had Rent-A-Kill in to try and do something with, but just, we've put down traps and everything, and we just can't get rid of them.
Bloody anchorites everywhere.
Yeah.
That really does sound like a sort of a 1960s kitchen sink drama insult. Hey, she was a bloody anchorite, she was. They used to have in their anchorage a tiny window called a squint, which enabled anchorites to participate in the service. And then they would have another window that looked out onto either the street or the cemetery for charitable neighbours to pop through food and drink and, one presumes, toilet roll, like pornography. Anything they wanted. So
you really hope you're facing the street and not the cemetery there, don't you? Because the neighbours on one of those aren't going to be handing you very many things.
Yes, excuse me. Just politely trying to raise the dead.
Yeah.
Would you mind awfully coming back to life? Thank you. They also would dispense advice through them. So in many ways, it would appear that anchorites in these anchorages are similar to hermits, but in this way, they sort of became like the machine in Big that Tom Hanks as a child goes to. What are those called? The fortune tellers. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
They basically became fortune tellers. So, yeah, so I looked those.
You're not about to tell us there was a Saint Zoltar, are you?
Oh, my God, imagine. Yeah. Imagine. But then I sort of went away from religious things, and I looked up just some great eccentric and occasionally heartwarming hermit stories. So first of all, James Lucas, born in 1813, wealthy gentleman, and became nicknamed Mad Lucas. After his, and obviously went on to have a famous comedy partnership with David Walliams. After his mum died in 1849, he barricaded himself inside his mansion near Redcoats Green in Hertfordshire and remained inside. Yeah, barricading inside a mansion, that's quite heavy duty legwork there, isn't it?
Are you sure that he wasn't just grounded by her before she died and then she didn't have the chance to raise the grounding before she passed away? He's just like, well, I'm following her instructions.
Yeah, he was like, well, my options are either become a hermit or engage in some very bad taste ventriloquism to try and alleviate this. So he remained inside this mansion for 25 years, taking regular delivers of groceries, which mostly consisted of milk, bread and gin. And I think we can all empathise with that right now.
Yeah,
he had sort of enjoyed being this curiosity. Thousands of visitors made their journey to Redcoats Green to see him. And he greeted them wearing an old blanket accessorised with a shotgun. Accessorised, yes. That is what the account that I'm reading says. He talked to the visitors through barred windows. He would even distribute sweets and money to children on Christmas Day. But he steadfastly refused to leave the house. Eventually, in 1874, a postman failed to get an answer delivering a letter. And the police popped in and found him barely conscious after a stroke. And he died a day later. When the police looked around the house, they discovered that he had left a fortune of £120,000, equivalent to about £9.5 million in today's money. Oh,
fuck me. Forget turning base metal into gold. There must be some way of turning gin into money by the sound of things.
Yeah, yeah, that's a hell of a steal, isn't it?
That's amazing.
Yeah. Now, next up is... obviously there's a lot of chat going around at the minute about how we're all suffering financially from lockdown, but the only people who aren't are billionaires who are making even more billions. Thanks, Bezos and Zuckerberg. So let me tell you a story about a nice millionaire. In 1962, Brendan Grimshaw bought himself an island in the Seychelles named Moyenne, and he spent the next 50 years transforming it from a waterless bushland into a national park worth $50 million.
Wow.
He said to have bought the island on a whim while on holiday there, and over the next 50 years, he planted 16,000 trees, created 3 miles of pathways, wildlife began to naturally flock to the island, which now boasts a huge variety of birds, 500 turtle doves, 120 giant tortoises.
And a partridge in a pear tree.
Of course. He just lived in a modest single-story house there. Tourists were welcomed as long as they respected the wildlife. And Grimshaw, who was a former newspaper editor, probably repenting for his sins, turned down all offers to turn it into a holiday park.
Amazing.
In 2008, it was declared a national park, and he passed away peacefully in 2012.
We'd all live in a modest single-story home if it was on our private island paradise.
In the Seychelles.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're probably right.
Yeah.
This guy I love. In 1929, there was a chap called Noah John Rondo, who was 46 years old, and he went to live in a remote area of New York's Adirondack Mountains that he nicknamed Cold River City. And he lived out a very sort of Henry David Thoreau. Was he a transcendentalist?
He was, yeah.
He was, yeah, very much a sort of like at one with nature, grisly man, I guess. Obviously, there's quite a romanticized version of Americans living out amongst nature and the bad side of that, I guess, are the doomsday survivalists who, again, having a belter of a time right now.
Yeah.
But I like the idealized version of those that, you know, are taken to the horrific extreme in the film Into the Wild. But he seemed to live a pretty happy, carefree, peaceful life. And he kept a journal that was written in a very deep cipher that wasn't actually deciphered until 1992. And people looked at this going, what incredible secrets of nature has this man learned and written in this deep code? But when it was solved, there were few secrets, and it was essentially commentary on the weather and to-do lists such as get a few loads of wood. Just love like how underwhelming that cipher is.
They essentially found all of his post-it notes.
Yeah, that's exactly it. But he did come out of his hermitage after the war. Before I get on to that, during World War II, he was apparently suspected of being a draft dodger, and he submitted a letter dated it might be the 4th of August, it could be the 8th of April, it's hard to know with America, 1943, that says, I never went to Cold River to dodge anything. Unless it was from 1930 to 1940, when it might be said I dodged the American labor failure, at which time I could not get enough in civilization to get along even as well as I could at Cold River under hard circumstances in the backwoods. Since I'm not evading, I did not make my first appearance at Cold River on the day that Pearl Harbor was bombed. What I'm doing towards the war effort looks like nothing, but that's all I can do, and I'm doing it, and it is this. I'm self-sustained. Which I think has got a kind of quiet dignity and honour to it.
I'm not costing you anything.
Yeah.
And that's as happy as you should be with me.
But here's a bizarre thing, and I couldn't find anything else on this. In 1947, and I think he'd sort of achieved an air of notoriety, as quite a lot of hermits had, he was flown to the National Sportsman's Show in New York City by helicopter and began a series of appearances at similar shows throughout the country.
Seems a change.
Yeah, it really does, doesn't it? Very odd, but he's not, wouldn't be top of my list to give after dinner speeches.
No, particularly if he was delivering them in code.
Yeah. I mean, I've done a few corporate gigs where it felt like I'd been delivering my jokes in a cipher. In 1950, sadly, the New York State Conservation Department closed the Cold River area to the public, leveled the forest and forced him from his home at the age of 67.
Oh.
And he then lived around Lake Placid before being eaten by a giant crocodile. he kept doing sportsman shows and worked for a time at Frontier Town, that I think is sort of like a Disneyfied version of the Wild West. and at the North Pole in Wilmington as a substitute Santa Claus. So it feels like the great capitalist America eventually swallowed him.
Yeah, sounds like it, all right.
But the final thing I want to tell you about, which as I said to Barry, as often happens with both of us on the show, we're 10 minutes from recording and one of us finds the thing, the most incredible thing. And here's what I found. In the 18th century, an unusual and short-lived fad grew up for ornamental hermits.
Beg your pardon?
Essentially, what it was is that they were... it was considered a novelty to have a grotto at the end of your garden where you would invite a man to live as a hermit and provide
no.
meditations and sagacious philosophy on tap.
Oh, that's like having a live-in magic eight ball.
Yeah. Strap in. There's some excellent batshittery about to come.
Sorry,
your way.
you say it was like a fad among rich people, presumably. Not everyone who had like a little garden, like farm garden, was like, we need to install the grotto because the Jacobs next door have one.
there wasn't sort of like a grotto at the end of the hovel.
Yeah, did they have like a Tesco's own brand hermit, and then you could get like the fabulous, like really like fancy ones from Harrods or something if you really wanted to?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. This was, these hermitages, garden, ornamental hermits, they were, you know, once you've got a ha-ha and a he-he and a hoo-ha, then the hoo-ha is obviously what Al Pacino is at the end of his garden in Scent of a Woman. You would get these garden hermits. So Professor Gordon Campbell of the University of Leicester suggests a chap called Francis of Bowlat was the first of the trend, living as a hermit. In the early 15th century in a cave on his father's own estate. That sounds like he was grounded again.
Yeah.
But I looked at some great ones. So call back to friend of the show, Sir George Sitwell.
Oh, yes.
His daughter, Edith, wrote all about these. And she wrote a compendium of them in her book, 1933 book, English Eccentrics, which I presume had a foreword from or about her father.
Yeah.
But she listed various ornamental hermits, including a chap called Captain Philip Thickness, who became an ornamental hermit in his later life.
I mean, that sounds like a great way of having it. If you don't have a pension, just grow a really long white beard. And when you're getting to that age, you go, okay, I'm now going to retire from whatever my previous job was and become an ornamental hermit. And it's a regular income, and you just sit there stroking the beard you've been preparing for the last decade.
Well, funnily enough, Thickness actually writes in his diary, I have obtained that which every man aims at, but few acquire, solitude and retirement. and he also wrote earlier, the duplicity of mankind and satiety of enjoyments all tend to show that even the splendid scenes which surround the palaces of wealth and greatness are never thought complete unless marked by some shady care and the abode of an imaginary anchorite. So I think it was sort of like in the way that kings have jesters to tell them that they're idiots. Really rich people wanted to have a sign of either sagacity or of just a reminder of the hard times that they could fall upon.
It's like a mini human zoo.
Gosh, it really is, isn't it?
Yeah.
A chap called Charles Hamilton, whose estate was at Payne's Hall near Cobham in Surrey, he put an advert for a hermit. And he said that the hermit would be provided with a Bible, optical glasses, a mat for his feet, a hassock for his pillow, an hourglass for timepiece, water for his beverage, and food from the house. He must wear a camlet robe, and never, under any circumstances, must he cut his hair, beard, or nails, stray beyond the limits of Mr. Hamilton's grounds, or exchange one word with the servant.
I really want to know where they placed that advert. what's the hermit's go-to daily read?
I don't know. I imagine I've got Anchorites Monthly.
Yeah.
Or no, Misanthropes Monthly. That's what it would be.
Yeah, probably.
There's another one here describing a hermit. He was a garden hermit in near Ashby-de-la-Zouch, near where your husband's from. And he was described as being his own master, lived comfortably, enjoyed a good dinner, a glass of beer and a pipe. Yet, in spite of these blots on his characters as a hermit, he claimed he was entitled to the name, as true hermits throughout the ages have been abettors of freedom. And it must be said that he conformed to the hermit ideal in sporting a very venerable appearance and a long white beard. There was another hermit whose his chief eccentricity was to own 20 hats and 12 suits, to which he assigned emblems, sayings, and mottos, so that wearing them about the village, he would display statements such as, without money, without friends, without credit. Or, would they the be flames...
like... Sorry, go on.
No, you go on.
Was that like part of it was written on the hat and part of it was written on the suit?
Yeah, I think so.
So like you could like play consequences with your clothes when you got dressed in the morning.
Yeah, I imagine so.
That's so good.
There's another one called Matthew Robinson, who became Lord Rokeby. I don't know who that is, but apparently quite infamous. But he was the son of a minor official under King George II. His eccentricity was to be submerged in a bath or spa as many hours as possible, even when receiving guests. He was known to speak voluminously on all sorts of advice. And he was compared to St. Simon Stylites, except that he was not giving advice from atop a high, dry, sandy pillar, but in a cold, watery tub.
Yeah.
Once again, long beard, long hair, and clearly a bit batshit mental.
Wow. It's like the call-outs for, like, mall Santas. Back then, everyone who's a mall Santa now would have been an ornamental hermit back then.
I should. Oh, you asked about how much you could get paid as one.
Oh, yeah.
Charles Hamilton's advert for 7 years, lived for a hermit for 7 years in exchange for 700 quid, or in today's money, about $77,000.
Wow. That's 11 grand a year plus bed and board.
Yeah. One of his, and this is the last thing I'll tell you about, one of the most famous ones was Father Francis, who lived in Hawkstone Park in Shropshire, and his summer hermitage, inside there was a table strewn with symbolic items like a skull, an hourglass and a globe, and whilst conversing with visitors again, he'd give them spiritual guidance and ponderings on the nature of solitude, and he was so popular an attraction that the Hill family, who owned the park that he lived in, built their own pub at the Hawkstone Arms to cater to all the guests that arrived there. On his death, or later on his death, a mechanical hermit was built to replace him, but it did receive a very critical review from an 18th century tourist, which said, the face is natural enough, the figure stiff and not well managed. The effect would be infinitely better if the door were placed at an angle of the wall and not opposite you. The passenger would then come upon St. Francis by surprise, whereas the ringing of the bell and door would open into a building quite dark within, renders the effect less natural. So even in the 18th century, TripAdvisor was still extraordinarily harsh.
That's like we're just on the cusp of the Industrial Revolution there, and they've gone and they've replaced a good, honest, hardworking human hermit with a mechanical hermit.
Yeah, and gosh,
did
I just thought...
Did the Luddites come and beat that hermit to death?
Yeah. Yeah, they picked a Luddite hermit who sort of like went there and then to go, because that's the thing, that mechanical hermit just taking away work from good, honest hermits.
Yeah.
So yeah, there you have it. We have been living in lockdown and living an unexpected hermitic lifestyle, but just to let you know that however well you're doing it, you are a rank amateur compared to hermits of the past.
Damn right.
As ever, thank you to those of you who have been donating to us for God knows how long, but particular, again, thank you to those of you who either began donating during lockdown or upped your donation. It's hugely appreciated, and considering that me and Barry ain't going back to any real-world performances till probably 2021, it's so welcome to enable us to pay our bills, get our groceries, and prevent my child from getting rickets.
Yes, if you want to join those magnificent heroes on Patreon, visit patreon.com/worstfootforward, where you can see the different levels of donation and the different rewards you can get for doing that. If you can't do that, because hey, none of us are making any money at the moment, unless you're Jeff Bezos, and if you are, in which case, please be our friend and give us loads of money. But if you're not, you can also just give us a shout out on social media. We're on Twitter @WorstFoot. We're on Facebook, Worst Foot Forward. Our website is WorstFootForwardPodcast.com. And you can also rate and review us on iTunes or wherever you listen to us. We've had a few very nice people write some very nice things about us on there recently, which is a lovely one came through just before we started recording this one. I don't have it to hand, but all of them, I have to say, and I'm glad to say, 5 stars.
Well,
you don't want to be the black sheep, guys.
beautifully manipulated there, Barry.
Yeah.
Well, we hope that these tales give you succor in these tricky old times, and we hope that you enjoy our next episode. Coming up on Monday, we are going to talk about the world's worst race, but not like that. But tune in to see whether me and Barry make a horrendous podcasting faux pas with our guest, Bethany Black. Until then, stay safe in your own little hermitage.
Bye.
Bye-bye.